I said we're going to play another new one now, Roundhouse, and we'd like to invite a special guest to the stage in order to help us do it. And he comes, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Mr. Bill Ryder Jones, please. This one's called Fireside, check it out. Guitar there, folks.
Obviously, you toured with the Arctic Monkeys and you played live on Fireside and maybe a number of others as well. Was that a bit of a weird experience, like worrying that you'd be treading on anyone's toes? And like, how did you, because obviously you recorded, I think it was Submarine, that then led into AM and that led into the tour, I think. Like, just talk us through that process and working with Alex and how you made sure that you weren't treading on anyone's toes in regards to the guitar work.
Well, treading on toes has never been an issue. Like, Submarine, I should preface this with, me and Alex don't talk and I miss him a lot. Like, I think I disgraced myself on that tour a little bit. I was using it at the time and maybe took the piss a little bit. But working on Submarine, yeah, was, because he's one of my favourite songwriters. When it came to AM, it was great. Like, this boss, like, they were in LA, they sent these tunes over, Al called me and were like, yeah, I just want you to play guitar. And yeah, it was quite special, man. You know, that whole tour was really special. It's a different life, you know, like big hotels and, you know, everything's sorted for you. Just turn up, someone gives you the headphone, gives you the in-ears, you play. And yeah, I wish I could have stayed more involved in that, because I loved that. I loved that experience. It was really, and being around someone like him, who I, like, make no bones, I'm very confident in that I can write good songs that convey emotion and can help people. But he's like that next level genius, that Bowie genius level, you know. So yeah, it was a shame that fell apart, but. Yeah, it was a trip. Like, it was. Yeah, I look back on that very fondly. Like, you know.
I mean, obviously, I don't know the details, but I wouldn't beat yourself up too much about that. You know, the trappings of that. You know, there's plenty of other people who have, you know, found themselves in that position, and you know, it's interesting also to think about Alex. So he became like really famous, very very young age, and critically acclaimed. How did he strike you in how he handled that? And like, what does he do well to make sense of that? Because if that's the only world you've seen, it's hard to kind of, I'd imagine, to stay kind of really rooted in reality. But
I honestly couldn't talk on it too much. I met him when he was about 16. We bonded. We the choral supported them. Me and him used to hang out and write tunes, and you know, we got on, and certain things got in the way. I might have been a little bit depreciating about some of the people in his camp, and as a result was cast out, yeah. But
Was Josh Homme about for those sessions? Because he produced some of their stuff around that time, or was it all James Hall?
I never met him there. Mm. When I did the monkey stuff, it was me and James Ford in London. They had three tracks they wanted. You know, this is a really nice thing, actually. Like, on Fireside in particular, I tried a bunch of things. And I remember Al calling me and going, like, it sounds great, but, like, in truth, we just wanted you to do the Bill thing. I just do the Bill thing, you know. And then I did the Bill thing, and they were like, ah, it's boss. And then I had parts for John Cooper Clarke's song, I Want to Be Yours. I had, but we didn't make the cut off. But yeah, it was right special, man. I miss it. Like, that's about fucking 8 years ago as well, yeah.
Well, any particular fond memories of that tour? Any kind of special, you know, if you could relive one particular gig or particular song of a gig, what was one that kind of really sticks out that was a great memory?
Man, the whole thing was incredible. It was. The one memory was driving up to Liverpool. Lou Reed had just died. So I taught them all how to play Walk on the Wild Side on the bus. Because I was like, oh, let's do Walk on the Wild Side, you know. And that was good. I enjoyed that. Was a sweet thing because what a song and what a thing to do, you know. And I'll never forget, he introduced me as your very own Bill Radich. You were in the Echo Arena in Liverpool. Your very own Bill Radich Jones, you know. Yeah, I'll never forget that. That'll stay with us for a long time, you know.
I interviewed Paul Duffy recently.
Oh, Paul.
Yeah. It went down well. It was a great episode. And we kind of explored, obviously, all of the Cole career, but also I asked him about you. And he actually said on the interview, he said, you know, towards a time when you were struggling, I think it was like, you know, stated as a stress-related condition or something like that. He says he wishes that he had been there a little more for you at the time. But mental health at the time was such a, not a taboo subject, but it wasn't so much the public consciousness. It was kind of, didn't know how to deal with it. So if you were in the same position, or let's say you were producing a band and there was a member of the band who was struggling, you know, what do you think the rest of the band could do more of or less of to support that person going through what you were going through at that time?
Well, firstly, I'm incredibly touched that Paul said that. And I'd also like to acknowledge the fact that Paul is a musical fucking freak. Like, he is integral to that band. Something I'm proud of is when I work with young bands, there's always one member who's not fit to be in that particular situation. So one thing I love is, I can't think of a session where I haven't had to pull one member aside and say, you're fucking good. Like, you know, you can do this. Like, however long you need, we'll get it done. Because, you know, just people, aren't they? So what I always say to people is, like, with the bands I work with, I always, if someone's on drugs, I always have a word and say, enjoy yourself, but keep an eye on it. If you've got a member who's anxious, I'll speak to him. I won't speak to the collective and say, look after him or whatever. Because that doesn't go anywhere, because if you're in a young band, you just don't think like that. You're just like driven into where you want to be, you know, where you want your band to be. Yeah, it's something that I'm quite good at, I think, you know, just, hey, do you want to, you and me, should we go and get a pint? Say, if it's a bass player, do you want to go and get a pint and we'll talk? Mm. And telling people that they're worthy and what they do is important, and it's not easy, and it's a challenge, and if you fail at this one, if you don't get your bass parts or your drum parts down this time, I'll look after you, we'll sort it out, you know, and that, I don't think that exists in the music industry. Very much, you know, it's very get it fucking done, you know, you cog, you, yeah, you, do you know what I mean? Like,
well, that's something, you know, you're producing bands now, that's like your, you know, that's your unique thing, right? That's your philosophy to supporting people. And you know, I just put myself in their shoes if I was being produced, and you know, I've had red light syndrome a little bit in the past, and you know, if someone said exactly that to me and just said, I'll look out for you, you know, we'll work it out, it's fine, that's exactly what any, you know, I'm talking 20 years ago now, but like any young musician needs to hear in that situation. So I think that's, you know, and I think you're right that...
Well, you see it in people. Every time I do it, it fucking works. You know, it works. Like, taking someone out of a professional, highly stressed situation and making it humanistic and looking them in the eye and going, it's all right. like, we'll do this. I've got your back. You don't have to stress, you know. It's that brings great results, you know. Happened with our girl, Brooke Bentham, Saint Saviour, you know. The conversations where you have to look someone in the eye and go, what you do is important. It's harder with working class lads. They don't want to hear that. That's a strange thing. But with women, generally, it goes down well. But with working class lads, or northern lads in particular, they struggle with it. But
they need that safe space to be vulnerable, right? So that's you taking them to the pub and say, right, let's go and get a pint, and just the two of us, they need that safe space to go, yeah, actually, I'm not feeling 100% about that. And you've created that safe space for them to do that, but it's unlikely they're going to do that in front of three other mates, right?
And you exclusively take them to a pub because it's where they feel masculine. And you can look them in the eye and go, let's, you and me have a pint. Tell me what you're into. Tell me what you want to achieve. And I'll fucking get it done with you, you know? And it's a beautiful thing. Yeah, I love it.
When it was kind of decided that you were no longer going to be part of the Coral, what was kind of the first overriding relief that comes to mind when that was actually finalised and agreed?
You made a lot of assumptions there, love. So I left twice. First time I left was after my breakdown. And they were very sweet about that. They gave me gardening leave. So I moved to Cambridge. I was engaged with a girl from there, and they still paid my wages, and they carried on. And then I came back about a year later. I moved about. I lived in Italy, and what was the relief was we'd already we'd just finished a tour with the Arctic Monkeys in Europe. They asked us to come out and play in America with them, which for the Coral was a big deal. I essentially was like, it's not. That's just not happening. Like, I'm not doing that. So I wrote James a letter and said, I'm not doing that, and I'm going to step away because you need to do that. The relief was, God fucking hell. Like, them 2 weeks before I realised how much money I had in my account. Yeah, I could breathe. But it was the most painful thing I've ever had to do. No, actually, that's bollocks. It's one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I still miss being in the Coral, like, you know. I miss the camaraderie, like, you know, I don't have any family, like. They were my brothers, they looked after me, they took care of me best they could. But relief. There's no relief. I left the band. I went to university. Couldn't cope with that world.
What did you study?
It was it's the most scouse course you could ever imagine. You know what we're like up here, scouted. It was the social and economical history of Liverpool. I enjoyed it, but that's when I had my first dissociative disorder, and that's when I got my diagnosis for the dissociative disorder. So I had to give that up, and then I moved to Bolton, where my partner lived, and I wrote If, and then Domino got in touch, you know, and that's how that worked, you know.
In a previous interview you've done, you said that writing, and you've touched upon this actually today, but you said writing music for me is pretty much the only way I can feel good about myself. And you talked about your dissociative disorder there. And you talked, you know, for anybody who isn't aware, there's a really nice analogy around the black dog. So the black dog is the black dog on the shoulder who kind of follows us everywhere. And if anybody doesn't know it, please go onto YouTube right now and type in black dog mental health, and you'll see a fantastic 5-minute video that's been produced. Which is, you know, I've got a friend who had depression and was in a very, very bad way. And he kind of just signposted everyone to this video to say, this makes sense. Like, I can send this to my friends and family and they now get it. For you, how does the black dog manifest itself for you? Like, what does, you know, is there anything that particularly triggers you that you try and avoid? Or is it just something that comes and goes, you know, that's out of your control?
Well, that's the strange thing. It always feels like it's out of your control. Like, neuroplasticity is the key to these things. Like, so depression, yeah, I get it on and off. But my main issue is panic. Like, you know, when I say panic, I'm going to be brutally honest here. When I speak to people about my panic attacks, and I meet people who've been like, oh, I've had panic attacks. Oh, this shit. My panic attacks aren't panic attacks. They're flashbacks to one or two specific events. So
it's PTSD, right? So it's a lack of processing some of the trauma that you had, right?
Well, it's complex PTSD. It's resistant. It's therapy resistant. That's a cunt. You know, it's the worst. But I think the one thing that awful species have got is 150,000 years of survival. So you survive. You just fucking carry on, you know. I don't believe in that old northern pull your pants up, get on with it. I just mean survive, keep going every day, turn up to work and all the rest of it. Largely, I'm quite a funny person. Like, I can see the... I grew up in a house where, even when my brother died, we would joke about it, you know? It was...
Really?
Yeah, it was... We would. And
was that like a coping mechanism? Was that kind of...
Yeah, you know, I think it was a skid mark of Catholicism and post-war generation parents who... How do you make sense of those horrors? You know, the only way is having a little laugh about it, you know, and you can cry afterwards. But with me, the way it manifests, so all my problems, like I like a drink, you know, it helps me write, it helps me feel better about myself. But I wouldn't, here's an example. In August, I could walk from my house to the swimming baths and swim. I would feel great, man. It felt fucking great. And then that stopped. And within a week, I'd get 20 feet outside my house and be filled with just, like, fucking intravenous terror. You know? That's how it manifests. And that's why I drink. And that's why I've lost some wonderful people through my coping mechanisms, you know? The way I respond to that. And after, when did I have my breakdown? 21, I'm 38, so 17 odd years. That's not an easy thing to, like, come to terms with, you know? Like, because I don't ask for any of it, you know? Like most people. But how it manifests itself is a pure terror, you know? Like... Yeah, I'm not sure I can talk about it a great deal, to be honest with you.
No, that's cool, and thank you for sharing. And you know, I said to, you know, for listeners' benefit, I said to Bill before we start recording this, so some of the listeners will know there's an organisation called Mental Health First Aid England. I'm an instructor, and I support a lot of people through this. And I'm kind of a little bit perplexed that you've been told that, you know, the type of, you know, PTSD that you've had is like beyond any treatment whatsoever. Like maybe some of the treatments you've tried, and I won't go into like the details of it, but don't like just shut off the hope that there is a way of kind of processing that, because there's so much research around, you know, for listeners' benefit, you know, I had panic attacks in 2005, and that was PTSD related. I was living with my uncle and he died in the room next to me, and I heard him die and I didn't realize he was dying at the time, and I did nothing. So it was a really, really horrible thing that happened. And like 4 or 5 years later, I ended up in A&E twice. And it was really interesting because back then they went, there's nothing wrong with you. And what they should have said is there's nothing wrong with your heart, which I thought there was, but actually they should have, there's nothing wrong with you, but there's obviously, you know, you want to get some kind of treatment. Yeah. And the way I got over it was that, you know, I told one person and they said, oh, okay, so you know so-and-so has that as well, and you know so-and-so has that. And I'd speak to other people about it. And there's some interesting research. So Jordan Peterson's a bit of a controversial character, but one of the bits of research he's done, which has been replicated, is that if you have a traumatic event in our lives, and every single listener on this call will have some kind of different gradient of trauma they would experience, if you think about it and it gives you that kind of shock, jolt feeling, that's because we haven't processed it. And he says that people are walking in the world right now with all traumas that are not processed. And to process it, if you do it as a conscious activity where you sit down and go, okay, what happened? Why did it happen? What would I do next time to avoid it from happening or to minimize my impact? When asked about it again, that jolting feeling disappeared. And so you can't change the past, but often the anxiety we get and the panic attacks, the root cause of that is unprocessed trauma, because we haven't worked out how we would deal with that again if it happened again. So, like, I'm not, you may have done that and you might be listening to me, Bill, and going, oh, come on, Chris, like, I've been through all this and it hasn't worked, and that's fine. But don't, there will be other treatments out there that will help you process, like, PTSD. And, like, you went through such a shit time, like, as a, you know, the thing that you've talked about, you know, that there will, you know, don't, I would just say, don't like see it as like there is no way that this will ever go away.
Oh, I don't think that at all. Like, I would, I'm blessed with hope, you know. Like, absolute. What Ben Sess is doing with psychedelic assisted therapy, with psilocybin, how we can open the brain, includes self empathy. No, I'm very positive about the future. I think in the next 5 or so years. People like myself will find a way to unlock. So I don't know about you, but my problems are locked. The beauty of the brain is it locks bad things back there so you can live normally. But ultimately, they're going to come. It's Freudian, you know, it's a return of the suppressed, you know. No, I have tons of hope. I'm not going to live like this forever.
Follow us on Instagram at The Stage Left Podcast, where you'll see behind the scenes photos from our interviews with members of Oasis, Queen, and Madness.
Just lost one of the loves of my life because of my reaction to those things, and I'm not doing that. I'm not having that anymore. I want kids. I want to drive a car. I want to be able to walk a mile from the house and not feel like I'm in danger, you know.
Well, you're progressing, because you say you uploaded that video that you went for that walk around the lake recently, and like any progress is like that's progress. That's it's cool, man. So let's talk about positive from your kind of childhood. If you could relive any 6 month period between the ages of 0 and 20, what would it be and why? If you could relive any 6 month period between the ages of 0 and 20, what would it be and why? What period would that be?
I'd like to remember more about my brother. So I have about 5 memories of him, and I'd like to know more about him. Because he's huge inspiration to me. He was, I know I'm a gifted musician, but he was something else. You know?
Really? So he played instruments and was a musician as well?
Oh, fuck, yeah, Daniel. Our Daniel was playing Dvorak's New World Symphony when he was fucking 5 years old on the violin.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
He was... And that's why I didn't think that he's the reason why I didn't think I had any musical talent, because he was so good. It was only when I went to secondary school where I went, "What? Everyone can't just hear a piece of music and play it, you know? What would I relive? Lockdown. I'd relive lockdown. That first lockdown, I had a very spiritual connection with the partner I was with at the time, and what I should have done was tackle my problems, but all we did was take drugs. And I think if that relationship could have worked, it could have been very, very beneficial and very wholesome. So yeah, I'd go with that, you know. But at the same time, like, I don't really subscribe to that way of thinking, you know. I think the shit things that happen, like, yeah, but I don't know, I'm fortunate. Both of my parents are, like, super working class, you know. I'm not a classist, I'm, like, you know, middle class, I'm privileged, I'm white, I'm heterosexual, I'm cisgender, and I, like, I mess around with lads, but, like, yeah, I think you have to let things have to be what they are, and you have to move with them, and that helps, you know. It helps me anyway, but... What's that gold disc you've got there?
The gold disc is John Lennon's Imagine album. I'm pointing up to, yeah. And there's a strip of wood underneath, which is part of his... it's the front door from his Tittenhurst building that's got Imagine.
Oh, wow, amazing.
It cost me a fucking fortune, which I couldn't afford when I was in America, when was it, about 15 years ago. And, yeah, it's the one thing... I mean, I was going to come on to, if there's one... if the house was burning down, what's the one thing that you'd grab... anything like music memorabilia or particular instrument that's important to you? What's the kind of one thing in your house that you is most important?
Can I show you?
Yeah, do.
There's probably a couple of things, but the one that I can see...
Yeah?
Aside from my fleshlight. I don't have a fleshlight. I get plenty of sex. Don't worry about that. I'm a mute. It's this. My dad made it for me. It's some photographs. It's probably hard to see, but it's my family before the trauma.
Wow.
Before all the death. And so, like, there's me and my dad. 1996, remember them good times?
Great time. 13 years old, great time.
Me too, like, 1996.
Euro 96.
I was wearing my...
Oh, you got the England shirt on, yeah, I can see. Yeah,
got me knocking about there, and me and our kids... playing on, and that's my dad after he had Land's End to John Rhodes, and me and Daniel there.
Christmas, is that a Christmas tree? Yeah.
Yeah, man. That.
That's a great gift. Have you got to digitize them, right? To take photos of those photos or get prints of them, right? Make sure you've got more than one copy, right? So if the house is burning down, you know, make sure you've got digitized versions of them.
Do you know, after the house burns down and they're gone, that won't, fuck it. You know, it'd be all right. Yeah, and this AKG 414, it's a great microphone. Other than that, I couldn't give a shit. Honestly, like, I got a couple of guitars and, yeah, I don't know.
When you go on tour and you play live, you played down this way recently, actually, and I was away, so I'm gutted I missed it. But how do you, with such like, you know, you've got four albums worth and obviously extra, loads of extra bonus stuff as well to play. What is your actual process to decide what is the criteria of a song that stays in the set list and goes? Like, is it dependent on what you played last time you were in that particular place? Is it, you know, obviously you're going to play some more recent stuff, so if you're touring a new album. But, like, what's your criteria of choosing what goes in and particularly if it changes from night to night?
It's, like, the most boring part of anything.
But fans care, right? So, like, fans really care about what set lists are. Like, they want to hear particular songs.
So what I'd like to do is, like, you know how Griffrey... he just sits down and just plays his songs. We, because we're not that big and we usually support, you have to do a support set. So it's all the songs that are a bit active.
Yeah.
I'd love never to play Tutu Birkenhead again. I'd love not to play Satellites. I'd love not to play Catherine Oskerson. But you do, so with my next record, I'm just going to do the next record. And then, again, referencing my God, Griffith's Resist Phony Encores, we'll do the album, and then we'll do the four songs at the end that everyone wants, which is just... But I feel like I do them a disservice. Like, if it's my gigs, like, it's such a small percentage of my fans who want, like, Tutu Birkenhead. A lot of people just want to hear, like, the beautiful songs, the, like, Lemon Trees and There's a World Between Us and that. But I got to be honest, this new album is very fucking good.
I can't wait. Yeah, I can't wait to hear it. So how many tracks have you written for it? And yeah, when are we hoping to hear it?
Got 14.
Nice.
Probably be out in November. I think it's the best thing I've done since A Bad Wind Blows in My Heart. I'm not a huge fan of the last two records. It has hope, like I said before. Hope. Give people hope. Because I know, I'm dead excited about it.
Have you tried to write about lockdown, or have you kind of ignored, like thinking just keep that separate from the writing process? Have you kind of, you know, we're going through a pandemic for 2 years, which is around the time you've been writing it. Have you kind of included that as part of it, or tried to keep it separate in regards to the lyrics? And
well, lyrically, no, I'm not. I wouldn't touch it with a fucking barge pole. But if you're a writer, and like the way writers work is they write about every day, so a lot of the songs were written during lockdown and reflect that. But I'm not, with the greatest respect, I'm not Tom O'Dell. I'm not gonna like tell people I had a bad one during lockdown in song. I'll tell you, I lost my fucking mind. But the songs I wrote during lockdown, they're very beautiful. It was the first time since the second record where I was like, God, without this, I don't know how I'm going to survive it. You know, that's dramatic. Obviously, I would survive it, but yeah. And the hard thing is like, my ex was my sounding board, you know? And so now I'm dealing with the fact that I've got this album that's largely written the image of, like, the first song on the record, the image of writing, then her sat behind me, enjoying me and telling me what she liked and where I should go with it. It's quite painful to play those songs and that, but it's only fucking playing songs, isn't it? You know, it's not like I work for the NHS or, like, you know, or my mum's, like, 80 hours a week cleaning for people. My dad's a gardener. It's not fucking hard work. It's just, But yeah, I just haven't settled on a title yet.
I think that if you're, you know, although it's quite painful, I think it'll bring something to the experience, particularly seeing it live. You know, it's going to be, you know, we don't want to see you like reliving your pain or anything like that, but just, you know, it's real and it's genuine and it's raw. And I think all good art should be that. So rather than going through the motions, in regards to, say, if you were playing one of your songs that you're not so fond of, say within an encore, for something like that, how do you kind of stay connected to that song? So like, what are you thinking during it? Is there anything that you try and, do you try and focus on a lyric in any way to kind of bring out that performance in you if there is a kind of particular emotion, or is there anything that you do to kind of get you through those four minutes or whatever?
No, man, it's just about remembering the words. Just remember them words. The only song that gets us is Daniel. I don't do that anymore. Or John. I don't do that anymore. Most of it is like trying not to have a panic attack. So just getting through them, you know what I mean? And got some audiences I'm like a middle-aged divorcee who believes in crystals and energy, and sometimes you get to a gig and you play the first thing and you're all together. The audience is there, you're there, and they're just with you and they just love you and they love that you're doing it, and it's so special. A lot of the time that doesn't happen, but it's the whole thing, as I'm talking, you know, the whole thing seems so self. You know, I'm talking about myself like I'm Christopher Hitchens or Stephen Fry, or I'm just like most people, I'm just like a decent songwriter who has a knack for having a shit life or having some trauma and can convey it in a way that isn't so narrative. That people can't, you know, you want people to hear what you're saying and relate, you know? Do you get me? Like,
yeah.
That's the job. That's like page one. That's the goal. And the amount of time, I get messages every day from people who are like, and my fuck me, it breaks me out. Like, they fucking love me and they say so wonderful things and thank me for, like, doing shit. And there's a guilt because I don't do it for them. I don't do it for fucking anyone, you know. It's just me boxer shorts. Like, trying to make sense of my existence, you know.
But the ripple effect is it might help people make sense of theirs.
Well, people have to make sense of their own shit, but if music informs the way you understand your life, then it's done its job. You know, I've said this many times, like, I look at it like dominoes. You just have to be, there's to be a few dominoes before you, and they knock in, they knock you in a positive way, and then you knock the next thing. So 10 years ago, when I signed to Domino, Lawrence Bell, who's been an absolute star to me, said to me, like, what you do isn't now. So when I was making If, and I was making Bell, he was like, this isn't now. But in 10 years, you'll affect people. Mm. And as a result, in the last couple of years, you know, you start to see it filter through. People like Arlo Parks and, like, are onto what you do, and it helps them and they become big. And it's great. It's just beautiful. I love it so much.
So Arlo Parks is a fan of yours. Is that right? Is that someone who's kind of cited you in the past as an influence on her?
Yeah, she's been dead sweet about me.
Nice.
Don't reply to me texts anymore, but that's largely because I'm a fucking pain in the ass. But
well, she's doing well. She's doing really well. I literally listened to her out. Like, she's been nominated for like one of the albums of the year last year. I was literally listening to it yesterday.
Yeah, she's unreal. She's unreal. Like, I'd give my favourite bollock to be as talented as she is.
We'll begin to wrap up. The two last questions I want to ask you. We're talking about advice to musicians and stuff like that. What's like a skill that you think every musician should have that's perhaps underrated? So what's like an underrated skill that you think would help a musician going into the music industry?
Ringo. Be Ringo. Just be Ringo. Get on. Watch Ringo on Get Back.
Yeah, totally.
And that's it. Like, serve the song, have no ego, shut the fuck up, let the geniuses be geniuses and support them. And he, God, man, what you'd give for a Ringo. Like, yeah, be Ringo would be my advice, you know. And I do this, we all try and write that song that's going to take our career to the next level. But that's not making you happy. Like, sitting at home with no payoff, write something that no one else could do, that is just you. That's where it comes from, you know. That just acknowledge the fact that, like, I mean, when I grew up, I wanted to be Ian Curtis, Kurt Cobain, Nick McCabe, but I'm not. Eros Childs, you're not, because you can't be. But you get that one song that informs you that you have something that they don't, and that's purely you, is everything, you know. That's what I think.
And finally, what's the best bit of advice someone ever gave you that shaped you in any way?
There was a guy called Alan Wills.
Yeah, I think he did a lot of it in the music, the Liverpool scene. Is that right?
So Alan Wills signed the Coral.
Yeah, that's right.
And he set up Delta Sonic.
And he passed away a few years ago, is that right?
Yeah, 7 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
And he went, when the Coral were making Invisible and no, Roots and Echoes, I was very unwell, and he came to me and he just said, like your journey is worth hearing. Fucking put it out there. I can't forget that, you know. That that stopped me from being paranoid about when the Coral heard my first record or my second record or whatever. You know, it's a very hard thing to get in touch with the thing everyone instinctively, women more so than men, but everyone knows in their gut what they should be doing. You know, if it's a breakup or it's a song or it's a fucking, you know, it's I should go for a run, I should eat better. Everyone knows what they should do. Finding that and pursuing that and following that through will give you more than you ever thought. I think it could, you know. Hope that answers the question, but yeah.
So thank you for passing on your wisdom, you know, sharing the personal challenges, you know, that you've had. They affect everyone on every level. And I reckon it's probably going to be reassuring to our listeners to hear you talk about it so openly. We know the kind of the British stiff upper lip is the kind of polar opposite way of dealing with any kind of trauma. So, you know, if anything people get from this is to, you know, make sure you talk about any challenges that might arise to trusted friends and family. And I think you've really done that today and shown how important that is. And if they can't find friends and family, to get that support professionally.
And unashamedly be who you are. You know, like, fold to no one. Give no one anything more than you haven't got, because that'll fuck it up. Work, the hard part is working out what you are. And when you know that, like, I'm obviously not in the best state, like, but I know what I am, and I know I can survive, and I can write great music that can help people. And I think that's dead important. Like, if you're a writer, if you're a young, if you're a kid, you know, when we're young, when we're 16, we write songs, we want them to sound like Joy Division or The Smiths or whoever. But at some point, you have to find the thing that no one else can do, that's no one else can do like you can do. It's all about you, your story. Even if people don't give a shit, it has to be about what you can do and how you're different from everyone else, and that will seriously change your life, you know. That's what I believe, you know.
Thanks so much for, as I say, your time, your wisdom, you know, passing on your knowledge and stuff. Good luck with the record, and like, hopefully it does come out in November. I can't wait to hear it. I'm so glad you're talking about it so passionately. I'm excited to hear it already, and genuinely just like, thanks so much for being such a great guest on the Stage Left Podcast. Cheers, man.
Thank you, love.
This episode was mixed and edited by Bastian Hughes, Bastianhues. And that's little Eliza Day, my baby, 4-month-old, who's making a bit of noise in the background, giving a endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring, or your website design, Bastianhues. He's doing a great job.